Welcome to Diabetes Unplugged. Welcome to this week's episode of Diabetes Unplugged. I am your host, Nia Henry, and today I'm being joined by the one and only Dr. Maisha. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I am well. I'm so excited for this conversation as well. Last time we connected offline, it was fire. And I already know that this is going to be a great conversation.
I'm so excited about it. Now, just like for the record, like I know who you are. And I feel like if people don't know who you are, maybe they've been living under a rock or something. I don't really know. So I just kind of want you to like talk your stuff and share a little bit more about like who you are, what you do, and just kind of how you became interested in your area of expertise.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I will start with, I am a mom first, a single mom with a very involved father who happens to live out of state. And so great co-parent. And it is a lot of the impetus for why the direction that my career has gone. I am a physician by training. Family medicine was my trained specialty. I spent the majority of my career practicing integrative medicine. That just means I married holistic therapies with the traditional training. And I felt that that was absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I feel like for myself, I had an intuitive knowing that I needed to integrate these two things even before I really knew the direction that I was going in my career. And so I went through traditional medical school, kind of studied the holistic along with it, went through traditional residency, again, starting to apply some of those principles, and then ran a private practice, holistic integrative medicine practice for 10 years before I transitioned out. And I loved what I did. I loved bringing the holistic to medicine because having both feet inside of, having one foot inside of both disciplines allowed me to empower my patients in the best way possible. During that time, I actually became certified in neurolinguistic programming, which we'll probably touch on a bit, and hypnosis, and a deep trauma-informed therapy technique called timeline therapy. And I did that specifically because what I was seeing in my practice was patients were coming in and they were, they were involved in their care, but there was often a block. And I couldn't always figure out, well, what's the block? And what the NLP and the hypnosis allowed me to do is to be able to unearth what was that unconscious block so that I could really empower them to be full participants in their healthcare and their well-being. So I continue to integrate that into my practice. And at some point I felt like there was a higher calling. I felt like there was more that I could do. I sometimes say I got bored, but I don't really think that was it. I just felt like I had hit a wall to my impact. And so I ended up transitioning out and coaching healthcare professionals and specifically people who had burned out, moms in medicine, actually, who had burned out, to help them find meaning in their career so they could actually be the best doctors and nurses and coaches and, you know, all the healthcare professionals that they can be. And in that way, I went from helping patients one-on-one to helping hundreds or thousands of patients at a time by helping my colleagues.
You have done it all. It sounds like you've been through so many different transitions is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of led you.
I'm sure, right?
I really, really love that. And I was actually, I told you before we pressed record for the record, I told you that I had a bone to pick with you. Okay. Because I actually just watched your TED Talk the other day. And I was just like, first of all, you did not have to do an entire 15-minute TED Talk about me. Okay? You didn't have to do that. But you mentioned something like, and I took notes and everything. Like it, I was just like, wow, she's speaking directly to me. And like, that just goes to show the power of the impact that you're having, right? You never know what who your content is going to reach. But it got me thinking about the impact that our childhood experiences can have on shaping our perceptions and beliefs as adults. And that's typically like where our triggers come in and they impact our current reality. So in your TED talk, you were saying, if we want to expand our consciousness and evolve beyond the current state of suffering, we must put our perceptions and automatic ways of thinking under the microscope. You said most of us are unaware that we're walking around operating on filtered bits of information. So we tend to take what we hear, see, and feel as the absolute truth. And when we take something as the absolute truth, we cut off all other possibilities. Mm-hmm. So it had me go all the way back to childhood and how our childhood shapes our perception of our current reality and how our upbringing and the things that we may have experiences or our relationships, how that all dictates the things that we do now in our adult life, specifically when it comes to our food, right? And so I want to unpack the conversation around just triggers. Like, what have you seen in your practice all your years? And you were saying that there's a disconnect between, you know, people who want to be involved in their healthcare, but there's something that's stopping them from being able to do so. And I feel like that's where the trauma comes in. Would you agree?
It is. Well, so there's trauma and then there's beliefs and values, right? And sometimes they're interrelated and sometimes they're not. Mm-hmm. There's cultural values. You know, we have cultural relationships to food, historical relationships to food. Mm-hmm. And then we have food related trauma. So I want to distinguish that it's a spectrum. And it's not one thing or another particularly. And I'm going to share with you that you're going to hear me use activation in place of trauma.
And specifically, see, I use that in place of feeling triggered. I try to say I feel activated instead of triggered. So we were on the same page.
I just used the wrong word. Yeah, activation rather than triggered. So yeah, you'll hear me use that. And so we're on the same page there.
Yeah.
And you know, just to explain to the audience, and you may have explained this to your audience once before, but I use the word activation rather than triggered because that's actually what happens in the body.
Right.
So like when we experience something that reminds us of some trauma in the past, it activates a particular system in our body.
Right.
And also because in the trauma-informed communication and the language that I use, I try to be mindful of violent use of language and not always perfect at it, but like the words like triggered, you don't know what that could activate in someone else. So we're definitely on the same page. And I know that for the audience, what they're used to hearing may be triggered, but I want to educate the audience as well as begin to use, if you begin to move towards activation, plus triggered has become sort of like one of those trendy terms, one of those, you know, everybody's using that triggers me. That triggers. So I just for the audience listening, when you start to hear us use that language, understand it is actually more accurate for what the body experiences. Yeah.
Mm.
So now coming back to your question though, is let's take food related trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Food related trauma could be related to scarcity or could be related to the conversations that are had around food.
Yes.
So, or the conversations that are had around one's body. Mm-hmm. So as an example, one of the things I experienced growing up personally was the conversation of, you eat to live, not live to eat. And you're eating, look at you gaining that weight. Look at you gaining that weight. You need to eat less because you're gaining this weight. Right. Yeah. And so that is, even though it may not sound like, oh, that's some horrible traumatic thing that happened. Mm-hmm. I think when people think about traumas, they often miss that trauma can be one big intensity or it can be multiple small repetitive intensities over time. Like, you
absolutely
know, death by a thousand paper cuts kind of thing, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so that became a conversation in my mind that actually distorted my own body image. Mm-hmm. And so I've grown up for years with body image issues. Mm-hmm. And no matter how intellectually I know that that's sort of like a false belief, what's activated inside of me when the number on the scale goes past a certain thing is this feeling inside of me. Now, have I done work on it? Yes. Do I manage it now? Yes. Do I love the way I look now? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I still understand that there are things that will activate that. So that's an example of a food or body weight related trauma.
Yeah. So when you were talking about cognitive shortcuts basically being like these filtered bits of information, is that something that would constitute as, you know, a cognitive shortcut, like just kind of like hearing? So if every time you go to eat, I don't know, a piece of bread or carbs or something like that, that we've kind of identified as like weight gain foods, you know what I mean? Would that be an example of a cognitive shortcut because you're linking that with, you know, the words that have been spoken to you in childhood or, you know, as you've been growing up and stuff like that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, could be. Or could be I go out to dinner with a friend, or maybe I go on a date, and the person who is sitting across from me when I order the food says, "Well, that's a big plate. You're going to eat all that?" And they may really be asking the question, "Am I going to eat all that?" Or if I eat all of that, they may say, "Wow, you were hungry." And I might hear, "Wow, you're a pig."
Mm.
Someone might hear that with a cognitive shortcut. Because a past thing. Now, I don't hear that because I'm a foodie and I love to eat. And
right.
If I decide I want to eat all my food on my plate, I will.
Right? Yeah. But then you've also done the work, though, too, to get to this place where you can have that response. And so, like, a lot of things that I've seen a lot of times in my practice, what I see is exactly what you said. Like, there's so much food anxiety. Mm-hmm. And also like the decision fatigue that comes along with that because of, like you said, the conversations that we're having around food. And it's not intentional, but because we're hearing it from a traumatized filter.
That's right.
That's our perception. It's like we think someone's saying you're fat or you shouldn't be eating that or whatever. Like, especially when it comes to like the diabetes community, that's a big, big thing. Like if you see someone who just so happens to be diabetic drinking a soda, you know, and someone, you know, the conversations we have like, oh, it's a cup of sugar or sugar beaties or whatever, you know what I mean? Then it's like that activation is triggered in their mind. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I guess my next question is like, what does the work look like? Like the work that you've done on yourself and that you help your clients through and stuff like that. How do we start to break down those old filters that create those faulty beliefs and perceptions? Like, I know one of the things you did in your TED talk, it was in regards to a relationship and seeing different perspectives.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that works in this case. Is it the same?
Well, no, I don't think it's the same in this case. So there's a couple of things that go into that. This is a sort of a layered conversation, right?
Yeah.
Number one is first the awareness that we listen through filters or that we have our filters, like mm-hmm. that in and of itself can alleviate a lot. But then we have to question the voices that come into our heads. We mm-hmm. have to question the voices that come into our heads. We have to question the beliefs that we have about ourselves. And a lot of times we're not even aware of all the beliefs that we're speaking on a day-to-day basis. We're not aware mm-hmm. of all the beliefs that we're thinking on a day-to-day basis. So the first thing I usually have people do is to notice the negative conversations happening in their mind. Notice mm-hmm. what the negative voices that are coming up each time. And sometimes they're so normal, they feel like the normal voice that it's hard to recognize them. So how I say is, what's happening in your body when certain things happen? And then when you feel sort of like the pit in your stomach or wherever that negative kinesthetic, that negative feeling is happening, what's the conversation that just happened before that? And then what happens is when you feel, say you're going to eat a piece of bread and then you get this pit in your stomach, you get this feeling, like this negative kinesthetic, this negative feeling in your body. What is the conversation that just happened in your head that gave you that negative feeling? That is access to the belief maybe, or the set of beliefs that are behind whatever that negative voice is. That's access to maybe even the trauma. So when you get that negative voice in your head, the next question you might ask is, when you identify it, the next question you might ask is, when was the very first time that voice spoke to me?
Yeah, that, see, and that's why I started at childhood, because you do have to go backwards. You have to go all the way back. Like, I remember there was a line, not to cut you off, but there was a line from a movie scene once that it was like, if it's historical, it's hysterical. And if you are hysterical and you're constantly getting all worked up or remaining in that fight or flight response, you're never going to be able to regain control and actually work through it, or be able to, you know, cultivate better habits or lifestyle choices or anything like that. So like, for example, if you grew up with damage and fear, right? That damage and that fear carried you through life. That was the catalyst for your decisions, because that's how you survived and that helped you move forward. But eventually you have to get to a point in your life where that rage and that fear, it kind of turns on you and you can no longer keep living from that same experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the ways that we, you know, one of the ways that we help release the belief is to release the emotion associated with it. So when you answered the question, when was the very first time that voice spoke to me? The next question after that is, what was happening when the voice spoke to you? Who spoke it to you first? Or what was happening that caused the voice to arise? And in the process that we do, the timeline therapy process, it's about taking different perspectives that allow the emotion to release, that allow you to gain new insight and new learnings that maybe you couldn't see before as the 5-year-old, as the 6-year-old, as the 3-year-old, as the 10-year-old, or whatever that age was, so that you can take new learnings about who you really are, about yourself, new learnings about the circumstance, that you can now move forward and release all of that negative emotion, whatever it is, whether it's anger, whether it's fear, whether it's guilt, whether it's shame, whatever it is. And so we do the work to release all of those emotions. And then we do the work to release all the beliefs that are connected to the emotions. And what it does, it just gives people a new view of themselves, a new view of what's possible. And then it opens up possibilities, right? It we talk about the filters, right? The filters are our past experiences, our beliefs and values, our attitudes, our environment. And the environment may change. Our beliefs and values can change. And this process helps to, this is one of the ways that this process helps to expand our listening and our thinking, is by opening up the beliefs. Like, oh, that was an old belief. It doesn't serve me anymore. I can let that go, right? And I can now elevate to a different values level, such that my actions can now be aligned with my new beliefs and values.
You said a key word, which is emotions. And I think when it comes to emotions, that's a very scary thing for a lot of people. Like, allowing yourself to feel the feelings, because with that comes vulnerability. And I think it's not so much the emotions, it's the vulnerability of experiencing those emotions that are really hard. And so I have a lesson in one of my programs where we talk about how we talk about cravings. And typically if somebody tells me what their cravings are, I can tell them what emotions they're experiencing, because your cravings tell on you way before you tell on yourself, you know? And so for example, I have clients obviously in the diabetes community who are addicted to sugar. Right. And so when you are craving sugar, it usually is an issue with self-love, issues giving and receiving love, you know, those kinds of things like that. Creamy foods are usually a signifier that you need nurturing, you know, you need to feel safe, like those kinds of things, you know. And I think this is a really good segue into like food addiction, too. Like when you're talking about our belief systems and our emotions, a lot of times we use food to self-soothe because we don't have the ability to express ourselves. Like we've never been in a state of safety within our bodies or within our environments where we felt like it was okay to say how we're feeling. So we use food to just kind of give us like that false sense of dopamine. You know what I mean? That false dopamine release. And then mm-hmm. we remain stuck mm-hmm. in that. And that's the pattern that like even that I get in sometimes. Like if, when I'm in a really emotional state and I don't feel like I have any tools really in my toolbox to get me out of this emotional state, then food becomes that comfort.
I want to say a little bit about emotions. And before I do that, I want to go back because there's something that came to me around the beliefs piece. Mm. When we expand our beliefs and our values around food and the capacity that we have to eat healthy, mm-hmm. then it makes it easier for us to make those choices. And I just want to share one thing about that because I think that this is a little bit relevant. Mm-hmm. When I was practicing at a big, before I started full-time in my own practice, I was practicing at a big healthcare organization and I was a contract physician. Mm-hmm. And I've always been, you know, food is medicine kind of girl, yeah. right? And so this older guy comes in with his wife and he had been in several times to see his primary doctor. And in his chart was, hasn't changed his food, hasn't changed his diet, hasn't changed his diet. Blood pressure was borderline. You know, mm-hmm. he was coming in for a refill of medication. Mm-hmm. So I asked him, what is the reason, you know, we established rapport and towards the end of the visit, I said, what is the reason you haven't changed your diet yet? And he said, well, doc, because eating healthy is hard. Mm-hmm. And so I asked, well, how so? And he said, well, you know, after a while of eating rabbit food, mm-hmm. right, I get so bored and I can't eat any of the things that I like.
Right.
And we've been trying, but then I just get bored and I just want that, you know, I want those greens or I want that, this and that. And I just fall back. And so it's not that I don't want to. It's just that I don't know how to. And it seems like, you know, eating healthy is just so hard. So that was his belief.
Right.
And the difficulty, I won't call it specifically a trauma, but I would say the difficulty or the challenge was that he had tried over and over and failed. Mm. And so he was just sort of, you know.
Right. It was like, why try again if that's going to be the automatic outcome?
Right. So in asking the question of, well, who told you that healthy eating had to be boring? Who told you that all you had to eat was this? What if you could eat the foods that you like and make them healthy? Mm-hmm. It opened up a whole new view, a whole new set of possibilities. I didn't even do any timeline therapy with him, but it was a reframe that allowed for a different set of possibilities. Mm. And so then I gave him some resources and I gave his wife some resources and they came back the next visit, blood pressure down.
Nice.
And he was so excited about all of the recipes that they had found. Cause I gave them recipe resources, websites, and like all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And that he could now see healthy eating being yummy, tasty, and not so hard, not so difficult anymore. So with the timeline therapy, that's what it does. It opens up the beliefs so that you see new possibilities.
Before we continue today's conversation, I want to address something that might resonate with many of you in the diabetes community. When diagnosed with diabetes, it's common to feel overwhelmed and resort to drastic measures like severe diet restrictions and excessive exercise. Yet this often leads to frustration, fear, and unpredictable blood sugar levels. I have definitely been there, and it's this unsustainable approach combined with the lack of guidance from conventional medicine that fueled my passion to create my 5-day blood sugar reboot program. This program has empowered countless individuals to naturally lower their blood sugar levels by 50 to 100 or more points in literally 5 days. Inside the 5-day blood sugar reboot, you'll discover an easy-to-follow blueprint that tackles the 4 pillars of diabetes reversal in a simplified, helpful, empowering, and achievable way. To learn more, join my free masterclass on how to naturally reverse diabetes and eliminate the need for diabetic medications and receive a special promo price off of my 5-day blood sugar reboot. Check out the show notes for more details and let's get back into today's episode.
I wanted to share that because I felt like, what is the manifestation of a new belief?
Right.
Right. I wanted the audience to kind of hear that. The second thing is these emotions. I just think just a word about emotions. One of the reasons we're so afraid to feel the emotion is because we have a lot of meaning that we put to emotions.
Absolutely.
Like, they mean something to us. They mean so much to us.
Mm-hmm.
If I cry, that means I'm weak, right? Like vulnerability is bad, or crying means we're vulnerable. But it's like we feel the emotion. We feel this discomfort in our body around it. And then we assign a meaning to it.
Mm.
When emotions are really just information. And if we start to look at emotions like information, it will point us in the direction that we need to go in order to solve the issue. What's the information this emotion is trying to give me? Oh, it's maybe around the self-talk. Then we already talked about what to do with that. What's the self-talk? When's the first time I heard it? What was happening? Is that even true? And if it was true back then, is it true anymore? Does it have to be true? No, it doesn't have to be true because beliefs are malleable. So I just wanted to say a bit about emotions. Like we make up a story about what experiencing emotions mean. And yes, they are physically uncomfortable. I hate to cry. I just don't like it. But, you know, I know that it's information. It's a necessary part of detox sometimes. And it's a signal for me. Like, how do I need to take care of myself? What's happening? What am I not doing? Where am I not sleeping or eating? Where am I not reaching out to my community? You know, what am I denying in terms of my emotions?
How do you get, I love the emotion talk because, so my question then is like, okay, you're at a place where you're like, you recognize like you are emotional, right? And that's fine, you know? And then you say, okay, we got to create awareness. Where is this coming from? When's the first time that you have, you know, experienced this and all that kind of stuff? How do you get to a place where you just allow that emotion to move through you so you can move past it? I think that's where most people get stuck. It's like, I'm riddled with emotion and I'm trying so hard to not let the emotion control me. But in order to do that, I need to distract myself. So I need to eat, you know what I mean? Because food is a distraction, or, you know, we use all kinds of things, food, sex, people, whatever, like distraction to keep us from feeling. But if our goal, and obviously it's going to take practice and it's going to take intention, but if the goal is to not allow our emotions to dictate our beliefs and then dictate our actions, because I believe that our actions are based on what we believe to be true about ourselves. Like you said, you were even saying that the brain is, it's trained to seek things in the outer world that match our inner perceptions, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's just like when we're navigating these emotions, and obviously we're creating a narrative, we're creating a story, we're giving it meaning. Mm-hmm. I get the whole awareness thing. I get it. I practice it all the time. But it's that gray area of I'm aware that this is how I'm feeling. This is why I'm feeling that way. And then what to do about it? Like how... That part is what's missing. That is the part that I see is missing. Yep. Can we talk about it?
Absolutely, we can talk about it. I love talking about this part, right? So first of all, I'm going to say a word that nobody's going to like, and that is called surrendering. But I'm just going to leave that right. Put a pin in that, right? Put a pin in it. But I'm just going to say that word because it is the practice of surrendering to whatever's going on in our body in that moment, allowing the emotion to come, however uncomfortable it's going to be. But it's a practice. But here's the other piece that I think is extremely important. A lot of times when these things are happening, we're in an isolated environment called our mind, right? So, you know, there's shame associated. There's some with you know, if we're using food to what's the word that I want to use to satisfy our emotions or to distract ourselves. Mm-hmm. A lot of times there's like guilt and shame associated with that. So we're doing it in isolation. There's not like a lot of people around to witness this. Accountability, that is the thing a person needs. accountability with a safe space. All right. So what that means is identifying people in your life who can go on this journey with you. That may be a coach, that may be a therapist, that may be a partner, that may be a son, daughter, that may be a or child, you know, like child or son, daughter, or right. sibling. It may be a mm-hmm. parent, whoever that person, it may be a friend. But find a person who feels safe, where you can feel all the feelings, be your authentic self, and experience whatever you're experiencing. So as an example, when I heard a podcaster call it the dark night of the soul, right?
Oh, yes.
So like the dark night of the soul moments, mm-hmm. right? And during, when was this? This was, it was after the pandemic. It was, oh goodness gracious. It was between elections. There was something that happened and I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember because I do, part of what I do now is activism work, anti-oppression work. And I really steeped in sort of health equity and things of that nature. And there was a decision of some type of decision made. It wasn't Roe v. Wade. It was something that was like one of the things. And then there was something that happened after that kind of like tipped me over. Right?
Yeah.
I was like, why am I here? Why am I doing this work? You know, and I was like really in a dark place. I have two friends that I know that I can call. Mm-hmm. And people may be saying only two. All you need really is one.
Oh, for sure.
All you really need is one, but it's good to have a backup.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really, really are, you know, fortunate, you may have three or four or five. But I have currently two that if I am at the lowest low, I can call and say, this is where I am, talk me off the ledge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? And I can be crying, snot, sniffling, snorting, whatever I'm doing. All they're doing is holding space for me. They're the safest of safe people in my life, right? So I would recommend that people start to look for those, whether you're struggling or not, mm-hmm. right? People say, well, you know, I'm not struggling right now. No, you need to have those kind of safe people in your life. And those are the people who you want to keep you accountable because they won't commiserate with you.
Yeah.
They'll hold you accountable, but in a way that doesn't feel harmful. So that's the piece. That's to have those people. And then there's one other thing is you have to practice picking up the phone to call them.
Yeah.
Now in the beginning, I had an accountability partner, back in the day that I have an accountability partner now for business, but for when I was dealing with like mental health challenges and dealing with, mostly mental health challenges. There were some other things. I had an accountability partner that required me to call her daily mm-hmm. for 30 days just to check in.
Yeah.
Just to check in. And it was a game changer. And then we went from 30 days to, every day to a couple times a week. And then after a certain period of time, a couple times a week to once a week.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have whatever level of accountability you need to get you through whatever times you need. So on occasion, when I would get down to my lowest of low, I would say we need to check in daily again.
Yeah.
Just to have a touch point.
Yeah.
Right. And what that does is it gives you practice on picking up the phone, even on your good days. So when the phone weighs 1,000 pounds, you pick it up on your bad days.
That makes so much sense. That makes so much sense. Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say is when it comes to moving through the emotions and getting to a place where you are being intentional about not letting the emotions, you know, control you. And I'll just use myself as an example.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize for myself that it's really important for me to express myself. I need to express it. in order for me to move through it. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? And I used to be really bad. And sometimes I could still be bad, but I used to be really bad at just being like avoidant. I'm good at, I got a switch in me that is just like, oh, okay, I'm turning off. I'm turning it off. You know? And I'm just like, but then something little will happen. And then it'll all come out like volcano type stuff. I'm just like, everything that's ever been wrong in my life will come out. And so I have gotten to the point where I'm like, okay, I need to express it. You know what I mean? I just need to be able to talk about it, like, and just get it out and cry and all that kind of stuff. But like you were saying in the beginning, crying is very uncomfortable for me. I hate crying. I hate crying because now that I'm learning, because of the meaning that I've attached to crying. You know what I mean? So I'm just like, and even for people that are listening, it's just kind of like exactly what you're saying. Having that accountability partner is really important, and you have so many options for who that person is going to be, and that's perfectly fine. But it's also really important that it is a person. I mean, well, I guess this is my question. Is it important, because you're talking about accountability, but the validation part of it too, because we're in this world of like, everyone's on their healing journey and you don't need people to validate you. You validate yourself and doing the inner work and all that kind of stuff. I don't know how I feel about that. Like, I feel like we're being forced to be these hyper independent people and not depend on any relationships, you know, for our overall well-being. And that gets really confusing too.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. So there's a complexity of this. Let me pull that back. It can feel complex, but it's not really that complex. Mm. Let me just start with connection mitigates trauma.
I love
that's
that.
Why we must connect. Connection mitigates trauma, right? Connection can turn toxic stress back into positive or tolerable stress. Okay. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you don't necessarily need someone to validate you, but what's useful is that they validate your feelings, especially if you are the kind of person who invalidates your own, right? Mm. So there are, you know, types of people, myself included, that will question, oh, well, maybe that's just this, or maybe I should just this. Or like, you know, I need to just get over it, or I need to keep it moving, or I don't have, you know, like, or maybe I'm feeling the way I'm feeling, but maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just me. Maybe that's not everyone else.
Right.
And I will go about life invalidating my feelings. And I have learned, this is why safe people are important. Like, when I'm feeling some kind of way, I can call my friend and say, I need to run this circumstance by you. And I need you to check me if I'm wrong, but I need to share with you what's going on inside. Like, this is how I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And so if, you know, there's a difference between validating the feelings and honoring the feelings. So she will honor the feelings and then either validate that, hey, your feelings are valid, or honor the feelings and say, well, let me give you another perspective.
And that's the accountability
part. And that's the accountability. Ideally, you would like someone who can do both. It takes a lot of work to be able to hold that kind of space and listen in that way. So you might have a person in your life who you, okay. You might have a person in your life where you just want to commiserate and be held. Find that person. Identify that person. You need, you know, like 24 hours just to be held and commiserated with.
That's me. Right? That's me. Sometimes I'm like, I just need to hear it's okay. That's all I need to say.
I don't need to fix me. I don't need no coaching. I don't need no nothing.
I don't need none of that.
None of that.
I don't need a solution.
Like, you know what? Let me just hold you. Your feelings are valid. I got you.
Yes.
Okay. Right?
Yes.
Then you may have a person in your life that's like, when you're ready for it, that's like, okay, well, yes, your feelings are valid. And here's some perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's your accountability mm-hmm. person. So it doesn't have to be that you have one person that does everything. If you have that person, boy, hang on tight and make sure there's some reciprocation there, or else you'll burn that other person out. That person will have compassion fatigue. So people, you got to do the work. You got to do the work yourself so that you don't become a taker.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. I've never heard of compassion fatigue, but that makes so much sense because I think we've all been in that seat. We've all been like that go-to person for people. And especially like for me, like I'm an empath, especially like when we have therapists in our title, it's like people are constantly dumping on us, not intentionally necessarily, but it's part of the work that we do. And so we take on other people's emotions and other people's, you know, things that activate them and their situations. And then we feel up to our head in energy and we're like, I got to decompress. And then that's where that burnout comes from. And so I'm learning that in my life of like, I think it's a combination. You have to have certain boundaries for yourself and what you're willing to, like how available you can make yourself for some people. But then on the opposite end of that, and what I'm hearing you say is that's the importance of a team, right? Like it's okay to have your therapist, but your therapist is not going to be your end all be all. It's okay to also have, you know, your sister or your cousin or your whatever, because they're also going to offer you a certain sense of compassion and understanding and accountability that is outside of your therapist or whatever. Like that team aspect is really important too, is what I'm hearing you say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And your team can be anyone, and your team doesn't have to be family, could be family of choice and not family of DNA.
Right.
Your team could be a combination of all of those things. And just to underline the point that you said about boundaries, learning to set the if you're one of those people who are listening, like, oh yeah, I'm the person that pours into everyone.
Yeah.
Learning to set those boundaries is key. And I'll give you an example. I traveled this past weekend to Asheville to reunite with the TEDx community. And we had just arrived in Asheville. I'm in Atlanta. It's about 3.5 hours drive. Mm-hmm. We arrived, we were hungry, and my sister calls. And you know, we're close, we're tight. But she said to me, so we were talking, and she said, well, I have a question for you. And she's like, I have a question, but I don't want to ruin the mood. So I said, well, what, tell me about your question. And her question was, you know, an advice kind of question, advice around receiving a communication. And so I said, you know what? I said, this is, I want to answer your question, but I can't do it right now. I said, can we have this conversation when I return from Asheville? She was like, oh yeah. I gave her my short answer, which was, don't listen to anything anybody else. Don't listen to anything this person says.
Right. Yeah. Just something quick.
Something quick. Like don't pay no attention to that. Mm-hmm. Right. Because of what the person had said to her. I said, don't pay no attention to that. You know yourself, but we'll have a deeper conversation about that another time. She was like, cool. So the key was, I said, I want to hear what you have to say, but I don't have the capacity right now. Can we have the conversation later? Or if, like, there are some times where I've set boundaries where I'm like, this is not a conversation I can have with you, period. I don't want to get involved with that. I'm sorry. I can't have this conversation with you. And I've done that with family, mostly. And I've done that with some friends where it's like, you know what? I don't think this is a conversation that is going to be useful for me and you to have. Let me refer you to who you should have that conversation with.
Oh, I like that. I like that. And then we have to be okay with the fact that that's our answer. And we also have to be okay that they are going to receive that answer in whatever way they receive it. And that's not our responsibility to doctor that up and make it a softer blow. If we know that we've said it with the best of intentions, you know?
Right. And it's all the delivery. Like, listen, you know, I want to empower you and this is not one of those things I can do for you. Right. This is just not one of those times. I don't have the capacity. I don't have the bandwidth, and I don't want to get involved with that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with you today. I feel like I was in like a one-on-one therapy session. So thank you for that. And I've learned a lot. And I think the biggest takeaway is that I want everybody listening to this episode to really understand is like you were saying, you have to do the work, and it doesn't necessarily mean you have to do the work by yourself. And when it right. comes to, you know, those things in your life that are deeply rooted in different trauma, that's where the work has to start, is really going back and looking in childhood and your upbringing and, you know, why, kind of asking yourself, why do I believe this? Why do I operate in this way? Why? You know what I mean? Because, yeah, we're talking also about food as well, but that's just a, I don't know what's the word that I want to use. It's a distraction. It's a tool. It's a sideline conversation. And sometimes we can make that the center point, the focus of our journey, when I think the focus is more so on doing the deep rooted dark night of the soul type of work. And that's really, really hard. But I think once we kind of, I always say life is a mirror, right? And that basically whatever's going on inside is going to project on the outside of you. And that's with the relationships that you have. That's with the habits that you build. That's with all of those kinds of things. And so it's important to take those mirrors that are shining outwardly and turning them inwardly so you can see what's going on the inside of you. And that way you can make sense of why I can't control my cravings, or why food decisions are so toxic, or why I'm addicted to this, that, and the other. It's a lot deeper than that. We've just used that as a tool to distract us from really what's going on the inside.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So Dr. Maisha, I truly appreciate you so much for your time and your insight. Was there anything else that you wanted to give us? Because I'm still all ears, but I know that we're running out of time here. But was there anything that you wanted to just have people really walk away with from today's conversation?
I think I just want people to walk away with the fact that our relationship to food is very much related to, you know, our cultural upbringing, our beliefs about food, our beliefs about our bodies, the emotions that we pour into it, the meaning that we pour into it. And so as you're trying to, or thinking about, like in your stages of change and your stages, your evolution, making change, doing that inner work will really help you with the outer actions that you that you take. Also, I want to say to you, Nia, thank you for having me on.
Of course.
And yeah, this was amazing. And I publicly, like I have to say publicly, I'm inviting you to be on my podcast.
I love it. And I look forward to it for sure. Absolutely. Well, thank you again. I hope that everyone that is listening right now, that you guys got some nuggets, that you took some notes, had a pen and paper, and now you have some things that you can kind of just walk away with and reflect on, because that's how you start with that awareness, right? So until next time, we'll see you guys next week. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Diabetes Unplugged. If you enjoyed this conversation, follow me over on Instagram to join the ongoing discussion sparked by this week's episode. You can find all my social media handles in the show notes, and you can also show love by simply giving me a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And for more insightful blogs, support, and other digital downloads, head over to queeneatsnutrition.com. Until next time, take care and keep striving for your health goals. See you next week.